Okay, hello everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the panel on that's sort of instigated by the NSF Data Management Plan. We're going to talk about data sharing. The title, which I've forgotten, is sort of like the NSF Data Management Plan. Why do you care about it? Should you care about it? Should you share your data? And we're going to have several several speakers here, and Luke and Jason is me, and Beta are going to moderate it. And Luke's going to introduce the panelists in a second, but I'm going to give a brief introduction of who we are. We're three graduate students that helped start the Davis Open Science Group. And if you don't know what open science is we like to think about different things related to sharing and exposing our scientific work in a more accessible manner. And those things range from open access publishing to sharing open tools, software, so people can use them in academia easily, sharing their data. So typically in a journal publication, you may only see the graphs from the data, but what if you can pass on the data? And that's specifically what we're going to talk about today. Open notebook science, where you expose your lab notebook to the public, and then other things like copyrights, trademarks, and patents, and how opening up your data interfaces with those things. And our group has three main purposes. One is to build a community here on campus so we can discuss these things and learn from each other, and also to share tools with each other. And then finally, to be sort of a lobbying group for the campus. We can try to affect policy so it can favor opening up academic work and knowledge in a more favorable way. So I'm going to pass it over to Luke. He's going to give an introduction to our panelists.
Jason, I'm Luke, and thank you all for coming. We have six very interesting panelists to talk about this topic today. First is Phoebe Ayers, who is a librarian here at the Physical Sciences Library. She specializes in engineering and computer science, and she's also serving a two-year appointment as a Wikimedia Foundation Board of Trustees member, and is the author of How Wikipedia Works. John Kunze is an associate director.
John is in the middle.
John Kunze is an associate director for the UC Curation Center in the California Digital Library. He has a background in computer science and mathematics, and wrote BSD Unix software that comes pre-installed with Linux and Apple operating systems, and contributed heavily to the standardization of URLs, Dublin Core metadata, and web archiving. His current work focuses on dataset publication, citation, and preservation. David McGee, far left or far right. David has been the executive director of the UC Davis Innovation Access since 2004, the technology transfer office responsible for intellectual property matters at UC Davis, including copyright, patenting, licensing, and startup companies based on UC Davis inventions. Prior to joining UC Davis, he was a co-founder of two biotech companies, where he worked in senior management positions for over 20 years, and he has a PhD in molecular genetics from Louisiana State University. James Carey, who's been kind enough to help record this workshop, is second from the right. He's a professor of entomology at UC Davis with research interests involving biodemography of aging and lifespan. He is a director of the National Institute of Aging funded program, Biodemographic Determinants of Lifespan. The program involves projects at 11 different universities, including Stanford, UC Berkeley, UC Santa Barbara, New Mexico, Arizona, and Imperial College. Paul Getz, to my left, is a UC Davis professor of plant science and genetics. His research includes biodiversity and genetic resources conservation, crop domestication and evolution, structural genomics, and molecular evolution. His research and teaching program focuses on the evolution of plants under domestication and relies on a combination of genetic and genomic analyses, coupled with fieldwork in centers of crop domestication, principally in Latin America and Africa. Mario Biagioli, hopefully I pronounced that correctly, is a distinguished professor of law and science and technology studies here at UC Davis, and is the director of the new Center for Science and Innovation Studies at UC Davis. Prior to joining UC Davis, he was professor of the history of science at Harvard University and specialized in intellectual property in science. Other current research includes definitions of patentable subject matter and the role of secrecy in science. So we have a very diverse group of panelists. So without further ado, I'd like to pass it on to Betsa to describe NSF policy.
Well, I just want to introduce briefly what we're going to talk about today. You're probably familiar with the usual cycle of data. You apply for a grant, or BI applies for a grant, you get funded, you collect data, analyze data, and then you publish some sort of interpreted summary in a journal. And that's what other people read, what they see. There are a couple of problems with that. It doesn't seem to be the best of possible world. Lots of times there are terabytes of data that never get out there. They stay in repositories or behind firewalls. The summary that you see in a paper is often not enough to give you a good idea of how the study was done, not to mention making it reproducible. That may not be all we want. Plus, an issue of accountability and transparency in showing all that you've done and make it open to critique. There are issues of data integration. If someone is studying malaria in South America and someone in Africa, and they all keep their data secret, well, progress towards innovation may be really slow. And so it seems that there is room for improvement to get the data more useful and accelerate the path to discovery or make it possible in certain cases in the first place. And if you look up, historically, this is not a new subject. It's been discussed since the 50s, if not earlier. But in the last decade, there's been a stronger push. And if you look up Science Commons or the Phantom Principles, you can get a good idea of what the discussion is right now. Which is basically trying to make the data transparent, accessible, and reusable, and get more information and better information out. Specifically, one big push that happened just this January is from NSF, who instituted a brand new policy mandating scientists that are funded by NSF to come up with a data management plan and share the data. And it sounds something like this. Investigators are expected to share with other researchers at no more than incremental cost and within a reasonable time primary data samples, physical collections, and other supporting materials created or gathered in the course of work under NSF grants. And grantees are expected to encourage and facilitate such sharing. That's for any proposal submitted after January 18, 2011. And grant proposal must include the supplementary documents, not more than 2 pages, labeled data management plan. Now, this is still quite vague and open to interpretation, so it's also a very good moment to join the discussion and figure out what we really want out of policies like this. So starting from NSF, we want to just talk a little bit how scientists feel about it, about sharing their data, the pros and cons, the strategy here, now we get to this better world where everyone shares, but in the interim there is some cultural change that needs to happen. I will talk a little bit about the intellectual property implications of data sharing. What if a patent can come out of the data? What do we do? And then we conclude a little bit more about logistics. Like, are there repositories out there? Who pays for the repository and so forth?
Thank you. So we'll start this off with a question for Jim. I'm trying to keep all the questions to 10 minutes or less so that we can cover a wide range of topics and not get too sucked into any one particular topic. And I invite anyone in the audience who has a question to raise their hands and get the attention of Jason or Betsa, and we can try to incorporate you into the discussion and make this a more meaningful experience for everyone. So without further ado, I'd like to start this off with a question for Jim, who is as I understand, one of the people here who has had to actually write a data management plan for an NSF grant. And we'd just like to get your thoughts on the process of writing it and how you decided to, or how you decided what to include in your plan, and what you said you would share and what you did.
Yeah, well, this, you know. So let me just preface this by saying, first off, I'm a huge believer in data sharing. And, you know, I've been here 31 years now. It's unbelievable, really. But in any case, you know, I've been burned, a little burned once, and even when I revisit that case, I go, maybe I should have just gotten on the stick and published this a bit more. But the net sort of payback of sharing has just been, you know, swamped any time that I've been a little bit concerned about, you know, being preempted or whatnot. And so that with sharing, you get other perspectives. Every data set that we've ever collected, and I do demography basically and aging, that there's, when people come in, it's a complementarity concept, is that they bring in other perspectives, other skills, and so forth. And so you end up being a co-author on these data that of papers that you would have never in a million years been able to write yourself. And everybody benefits from that. They do, you do, all the scientific community and so forth. So I'm a big believer in that. Now, when we got in, for one thing, the I direct a PO1, when we sent that in, it came back for review and they said you better develop a better data management problem. So that was an incentive right off the top. And but most of them that I'd seen, they were sort of a paragraph, just you know, sort of a token accountability that yes, we're gonna share the data, we're gonna archive it. But the way I see it is it goes well beyond sharing and archiving, is that the data management starts from, you know, from the very, very beginning. And this curation center that John Cunson and others down in Oakland have developed, this is one of the first in the country from what I can tell. And it's a fantastic concept. And even in early discussions in our PO1, it was like, now this is a place to archive it. But after we're all done, and then people can share it. But the way I see it, and I think the way they see it too, is that from the very beginning, you're storing your data there, you're using to manage it, and then you can have degrees of sharing throughout, sharing within your program, share to the outside as you work through the data and so forth and publish it. So it's really sort of a living, breathing concept here. And so let's see, what else can I say here? You know, and so we have a couple pages in this PO1 where we address this data management concept, and then each of the projects within that would develop their own. So it's really well developed. I think it's a great development at NSF and NIH. I think it's going to follow suit there in terms of mandating it. Let me just say one last thing too, is that in terms of data sharing, is that there's data sharing, and I know you, as a young scientist, you're not going to get up here preempted. I mean, there's that concern, but I always feel that just when you get to the point where you really have the jump on things and you're moving forward with the paper, is that you start sharing, and then you get this synergy. You vet it so that if you're on the wrong track, you get some feedback right there. It's a good thing. People that don't share, I'm also an ecologist, and there was a turtle ecologist, and I swear he's going to take his data to the grave over no matter what. And I think there's part of not sharing because of fear of preemption, but then there's part of sharing. It's like, if I'm going to go out and hit boots at 3 o'clock every morning in this Michigan swamp, nobody's going to get these data. They haven't paid their due. It's too easy. So anyway, I can chime in as needed throughout.
Thank you. Does anyone else on the panel have any personal experience with writing or reading data management plans that they'd like to add any comments to? Or from the audience? Question?
I just wonder if you could define the data. Are we talking about literally the you know, the bits and bytes and results? Are you talking about the protocols and how the procedures you use for analyzing and the sort of all the data around how you did the experiments and that kind of thing? Is that also data that you would maybe put in the curation set?
I always think of data as the as the results is what I'm talking about here, basically. I mean, sort of the protocols and so forth. I guess I guess you could extend it to that, but I'm focusing primarily on the Excel sheet with the data exposed.
So the NSF has an FAQ page, which I have printed out here, and they're vague, understandably, right? What constitutes data covered by a data management plan? And their answer is, what constitutes such data will be determined by the community of interest through the process of peer review and program management. So that seems unhelpful, but then they say this may include, but is not limited to, data publications, samples, physical collections, software, and models. So think about replication and think about how you can generate useful information out of this body of data, whatever it may be. You know, is there associated metadata? Maybe that's the protocols. What would you use to effectively use it?
You know, when they say write a paper so that someone can read it and redo it exactly, that but for real.
Yeah.
One quick comment about this, very fuzzy definition of data that you find in the NSF documents. I was reading the guidelines from the Directorate of Education and Human Resources. They list videotaping a workshop as data. So the definition of data is really, really fuzzy. And in addition to that, it seems to mix kind of apple and oranges. Like, for instance, it's not just really data meaning numbers, but, for instance, physical collections, which one would assume to be, to fall, under the rubric of material transfer agreements. But instead, the NSF doesn't really draw the line very clearly. So it's completely a work in progress, as far as I can tell, based on the documents.
John, has a comment?
I'm kind of just second that these are all works in progress. I think the NIH and other funding agencies, NSF, NIH, are feeling their way through this to figure out what this is going to be. And PB made a good comment that the overall goal, the first principle, would be reproducibility. And so if you're a scientist that doesn't gather data, but you have synthesized data sets from other data sets, your processing techniques, formulas, clear listing of all your sources is going to be really important for reproducibility. So that's probably where it's going to go, but the requirements haven't been caught up there yet.
Yeah, I'll just add, the NIH has been doing this for a few years now, and they haven't mandated it for all grants, but they've mandated it for the big grants, for the over $500 million grants since 2004, I think. And so in their FAQ, when they say, what do you mean by final research data, which is what they include, they say, by final research data, we mean recorded factual material commonly accepted in the scientific community as necessary to validate research findings. Okay, so somewhat unhelpful, but final research data do not include laboratory notebooks, partial data sets, preliminary analyses, drafts, gels, samples. So
one quick comment from Paul, and I think we're going to have to move on to the next topic.
I think that we have to look at what is the intent of what NSF wants to do and others. And I think that there's reproducibility, like as was mentioned before, but also be able to join the data in a bigger data set, for example, through meta-analysis. And both things, reproducibility and joining the data, would require that we don't have access only to the data in a spreadsheet. And even a spreadsheet, what does that mean? Is that, in Excel, that's a proprietary format. Do we really want to store things in a proprietary format? We have to look in the future as to what format the data. But we also need, in addition to the data, we need the protocols. We also, in some cases, need the materials, the biological materials, for example. Because for reproducibility, you're going to have to go back. And so I think that this is a really big task. But we need to take into account all of these elements if we really want to go by the intent of this initiative, really.
Thank you.
Question?
Yeah,
question.
So I just wanted to be
collected 15 patient samples, like a blood sample. Am I sharing those blood samples that I saved for further experiments? Am I offering those for other researchers to use those blood samples for additional experiments? Am I saving it to defend the reproducibility of that experiment? What am I doing with as when you go back past the numbers to the actual sample?
Anyone here want to comment on that?
My reading of the requirements is there's no requirement on the sharing of physical samples. So I think it's really, but that's as far as my knowledge goes.
Except that there are two words, physical collections, that are in the definition of data.
Is this on?
Yeah, you're good.
My question can be posed in one word. When do we have to share it, or when is it proposed that we share it? Do we share our proposal, for example? Do we share results from the very beginning of the ongoing of the grant, or are we only obligated, and is it envisioned that we would share at the end of the grant after our results are complete?
I think this is something that's supposed to be determined by the community that you work with, and whatever is determined to be reasonable by the community is defined.
I think even defining what sharing means, it cuts both ways. It's not just us or me sharing data with someone else. In fact, I might like access to their data as well. And so when this comes up where you want to challenge the results and you get a response that they've not finished publishing with those data, they have other papers they want to publish out of it, then it makes it inaccessible. You can sort of play this game for a very long time, it seems to me, until maybe the grant ends and you're supposed to post it. Does that mean at that point is it mandated that you post the data? I'm not sure.
John, there's a great deal of wiggle room in the, you could embargo the data, you could, there's possibility of commercial exploitation, even there possibility of, if you need this to, they're very vague about it. So I think they're trying to give the researchers enough room to complete their studies, to even to hold it, as long as it's, I think the idea is to make sure that the data is not lost. At the very least, you put it in an archive, which may be dark for a period of a year or 6 months. But
after what?
After publication, generally that's the date that most people seem to be interested in, as opposed to after collection. So I can let others know.
I always think about it as a librarian. You guys come to the library looking for papers, right? Sometimes these papers are from 6 months ago, sometimes the papers are from 20 years ago. In those cases, in both of those cases, if you want to know, how did this person do this? Where are these, where are their data? We've got nothing for the papers that were published 20 years ago, right? We're starting to be able to answer that question for the papers that were published 6 months ago. And I think that's the idea, more than, yes, you have to make it open immediately. Can somebody access this in the future? We hope so, right? So the NSF is extremely big.
Can I just add a couple of comments? Back on the previous question about samples and what do you have to keep your samples for, the overlying message throughout this whole policy that NSF has and NIH as well is what's reasonable. This is a work in progress, and reasonableness is going to vary a lot depending on what discipline, what exact experiments you've been doing, how long you have to keep this sample on ice or preserved somewhere. And if it's a blood sample, for example, that's a finite sample. You may not be able to release that. There are many possible reasons why you may not be able to give that physical sample out to somebody. But if it's something that's like a hybridoma cell line where you're getting lots of it, then you may be able to preserve that and get that out. So it's going to be on a case-by-case basis of what's reasonable and how fast you have to make it available. So I think you have an opportunity as this goes forward to make commentary about what you think is going to be reasonable in your areas, because this is going to be a work in progress going on and on for years.
Question?
I don't know if I'm getting close enough to this. My lab is looking at it not just from what we can reproduce, but also what failed in the past, and that way we don't keep repeating over and over. And so we've looked at trying to get our data in a accessible kind of spreadsheet. So I'm wondering, did you, particularly Dr. Carey, did you work with a statistician or something to help you format your data? I mean, you have so many parameters and everything, and obviously you know your data best, but sometimes it's harder to know what the next person's going to want to look at and everything. We're having problems just getting the data together.
No, this is a great question, because just the mechanics coming up with a coding concept that would cut across all projects. I mean, we have six different, well, four now, but anyway, in two cores, you know, this is a non-trivial concept. So we came up with, I mean, every file would be dated, and so that we have some sort of uniformity there. But I mean, even with that, now you get into an Excel sheet. I can't even remember from the year before how, what these codes mean and so forth. You set up a key, you know, and so much less 5 or 10 years ago, much less somebody else that gathered the data. So that's a huge challenge. I don't have a solution for it, but I mean, when we talk about data sharing, you get this file. Sure, you can have the data, but it takes, you know, 6 months to sort through it and make sense of it, and lots of back and forth and so forth. So that's always going to be the challenge, but yeah.
Is there another question?
I was just wondering about the challenges of human subjects research, so in terms of privacy concerns, so like the medical sample or social science data interviews or surveys, just if, what the dialogue is about, how to deal with that, and also to maintain replicability that you're looking for.
We have human subjects where there's special, I mean, there's confidentiality issues and so forth, and so that's all the curation center. You have all different kinds of levels of accessibility, and so that this is, you know, you just work through these protocols on the confidentiality issues of that. But maybe John can speak to that. Is more informed on this side.
Well, I'll just say that's true. We have all sorts of nuances of access that can be built in, and I think once again, NSF's requirements would be easily trumped by HIPAA requirements as NSF goes forward. But right now, I think you consider that all personal data, that the importance of keeping that private is more important than the requirement, the sharing requirement, I guess, my speculation.
Question from, and actually, could anyone who wants to ask a question, could you just first start by introducing yourself?
Oh, my name is Sarah McCullough. I'm a PhD candidate in cultural studies. And this actually comes off of that question. I'm wondering, are there conversations between the NSF and international review boards for human subjects? Because that seems, well, you know, obviously an important step as the person putting together a research project.
I'm not sure about the NSF, but I would encourage you to look at the NIH guidelines, because, of course, this is what they do, right? They deal with human subjects. So they've been written a lot about the privacy of subject data. And I can't quote it exactly, but they've been concerned with this issue.
The NSF, if you look at the Directorate for Social Sciences and the Directorate for Education and Human Resources, they have plenty on that topic.
Thank you. I think I'd like to ask one of our next questions. Actually, did we have a question? Moving on a little bit into a slightly different topic, but related. This question is directed at Mario. One of your areas of research is the role of secrecy in science, and I was wondering if you could comment on
IUC secrecy as being beneficial or detrimental to research and how it intertwines with this new requirement?
So I would say that historically secrecy is pretty much the default setting. I mean, you know, openness is a relatively recent development, but that doesn't mean in any way that you know, history should be used as something to learn from. What I find interesting, you know, given you know what I've seen about people being extremely proprietary in the past, I find it puzzling that in the discussion, especially I'm referring to the you know NSF position, in the discussion about you know pushing for the you know data sharing and so on, there is actually no discussion of the credit that people whose data is being used should get. So there is a kind of a sliding. So the position you know about well you know you need to make the data to back up your claims available, that's clear enough. But then there are also specific references, especially in the the chemistry directorate, about the fact that the idea is to create databases that other people will be able to search and do this kind of meta-analysis. It seems peculiar to me that, I mean, to go back to the argument about, look, you know, I've really, there is a lot of sweat behind this research, I'm not sure I want to make it, you know, available. It's puzzling that there is no mention of, okay, what are these people going to receive if somebody, you know, publishes some interesting results based on massive data mining throughout all these various databases. So that's to me, I mean, speaking from, you know, historically, it's bizarre that there is no, you know, that issue is not being addressed.
So yeah, like the issue of attribution.
Yes. So basically, you know, you know, trying to put data as part of authorship, right? You know, how come there is no concern with the, if you want data authorship? So.
Does anyone?
Yeah, I'll just Jim. So you know, the Berkeley database on the mortality. Is that this is open access, but they just ask that people, there's some sort of login so they know who's using it. There's a few conditionals on using it. But it seems to me that that same concept, and this is a really good point, you could, you know, data that are conditional on you working with the researchers, that sort of thing. And so there's all these levels here from just anybody can have it to that it's conditional on we work together and work something out and so forth. So. But that should be built in as well, I agree.
It seems like it's really tied to the licensing of the data, and maybe Phoebe could comment on these various scientific licenses on data, and I think there's some relation to the attribution with those licenses.
And maybe we can also start by saying, who owns the data right now? Mm-hmm. And that produced at UC Davis.
I thought UC Davis
did. It does.
Can you comment on that a little more, David?
I thought that said it all. For research that uses UC Davis research facilities or funding or both, the university does have an ownership position in that. So that's the way it is. But that's not to be confused with, that's data that I'm talking about, not copyright to publications, scholarly works like that belong to the professors. Inventions that might arise from the data, ownership varies depending on who the inventor is. If it's a professor or somebody else who's paid by the university or is using university facilities, the university would own the invention arising from that, except for example, students who have registered for a course and they discover something during the course of that coursework, then they would own that data. I mean, they would own the data and the invention. So it's always on a case by case, and sometimes we have mixed ownership. Therefore, when a professor and a student are collaborating, the university might co-own it with the student. We have that all the time.
So maybe John, you could comment on when you submit data to the CDL. What are the license requirements, if any at all, on what you submit?
we consider that the depositor of data has actually ascertained, figured out what the rights are. We do not establish any further rights on it. We consider the depositor's business, they manage it, whether they own it or not, they manage it. So we're agnostic about that. I do want to go back to that incentive question.
Sure.
But, this is the right time. Acknowledge that it's huge. It takes a lot of effort to prepare data for sharing, and who knows if it's worth it and it's not rewarding. So in light of that, the California Digital Library became founding members of the Global Data Site Consortium, which is trying to establish the regular practice of citing data sets so that we can't change the culture, but we can prepare the culture, if it wants to change, to create these things that look like publication citations, but they're really data set citations, so they can accurately identify sources of data and eventually become part of the sort of impact factors that tenure and promotion committees will look at. And this is, hopefully this could be enough to actually help push the cultural change. It really has to come out of the academic culture itself. I'll also mention we're conducting a pilot to establish this sort of data paper concept. Data sets are pretty exotic, but publications are not. If you could create a sort of a cover page for a data set, which included a title, author list, abstract, persistent identifier, into some stable storage, you've got something that sort of starts to look, sort of figure out, this might be a publication, and it doesn't go further than that, but just links to all the data. You think we might, this could ease adoption of this kind of thing, again, hopefully, catalyzing cultural change and the incentives and visibility for the data.
Well, Beta, I feel like since we mentioned the CDI, we should interject a small informational PSA about what it is and what we're talking about. The California Digital Library is a consortial digital library based in Oakland for the 10 UC campuses and for the 10 UC campus libraries, and they do lots of work for all the libraries in the UC system, including buying all the journals that you have access to, negotiating those licenses, but they're also working on things like data archiving, producing a scholarly repository for data for publications as well. It's called eScholarship. And have put together some pretty fabulous resources about data management plans. There's a webpage about data management plans, including all this information from the NSF and like what the steps are that you should consider. You can go to the CDL directly and find that information and contact them and get help. You can get there through the libraries here on campus. If you search for data management plan on the website, you can talk to me, you can talk to Deanna in the back, and we can help you get in touch with those services. So that's the explanation for
Paul. Quick comment and question.
Yeah, I agree with John that there is a change in culture that is needed. Especially the recognition that these databases require a lot of work to set up. And it goes contrary to the scientific culture where you say, what is your hypothesis? Well, the hypothesis, there is no scientific hypothesis. Generally, I think in the constitution or the development of a database. So it would be difficult to have a scientific paper out of it. But it's still a huge amount of work. And so, even if people use the database, they don't give credit to the people who develop the database, because in that scientific culture of the hypothesis testing, if you just provide a resource, you normally should not get co-authorship, because it's just, what is the intellectual contribution? That is the question that comes. Well, just giving the database there all ready to go is not considered in general to be an intellectual, substantial intellectual contribution. So we need to kind of move around, develop this new culture where actually the development of databases is recognized.
Jim, quick follow-up on that. That is that the way we think about it, difficult no matter what, to to bring a database, I mean, to format it and make it accessible to others. But it's really difficult, you know, if you've done it ad hoc initially and then you have to bring it together, a separate effort. But if you build, the way we think about it now is at the very early stages before the data are even collected, that it will be posted eventually and accessible, and so that you build that into your planning and from the very start, so that then it's not an extra effort and now we have to reformat and make it transparent, that sort of thing. I'm gonna make one other point here. Oh yeah, on all this data, you know, I mean, the data intensive science is sort of where things are moving here, and so that all these databases, you know, all the data, many of us, at least I anyway, you revisit some of these data and you see it through a different perspective or whatnot, and so that you can go back to those same data. So it's not just for sharing, it's also self-serving as well.
I think it's great we're getting it right at the challenges and the need for a different culture, the need for incentive, the need for giving credit, the need for leaving enough time for people to do whatever they need to do with their data before sharing. And I would like to know also who has seen any benefits from sharing data. We see the huge effects of the human genome and gene bank projects being open and being accessible to everyone. So I wonder if you, both audience and panelists, experience any new collaboration or new publication to be more open than usual? And, or have you received an email asking you to share data and have you responded?
I bet I have 10 to 15 publications just on that. As I said up front, is that when you share with people, I mean, the professional mathematicians, for example, I'm more of an experimentalist and so forth, they do things that I couldn't possibly do. And they have ideas, not just data analysis, it's a matter of whole new perspectives through modeling. And so that every time I've shared data like this is something really good has come out of it.
Anyone in the audience with
an answer? I can't speak from personal experience, nor can I speak about any changes or any recent changes, but I do know scientists who essentially do their science based on the very difficult extraction of data from other scientists, often with phone calls and emails, and they obviously their careers are based on this, so they're getting a great benefit from it. And they want it to be a lot easier. So I think the hope is that this will, this kind of, these NSF requirements will make it easier.
There is some negative evidence. If you look at the studies that have been done on the so-called anti-commons, Eisenberg, Cohen, Walsh, and so on, they show that IP does not seem to be a major constraint. That is, few scientists have given up their projects because they couldn't get licenses. But instead, many more have given up projects because of the inability to secure, an MTA. So if we are the material transfer agreement, so try to get things from another. So if data can be treated closer to the things that people exchange with MTAs, then there is negative evidence that probably not sharing data could be more restrictive, than could create more constraints than actually IP. So based on the analogy between data and things, if that's a tenable analogy.
I think that what Mario just said is absolutely true. I think you can draw a parallel between data and materials. And all this discussion we have about storing data and availability of data, you could also look at it in terms of materials, storing, availability, and biodiversity in general. I think that the developments in the last 20 years have been extremely negative in terms of exchange of biodiversity, materials, and so on. Everything has become much more restrictive, and it's now at the level of entire countries, actually. Countries will prevent the access and the exchange of their biological materials. And that is since the Convention on Biological Diversity in 1991. There have been a few more treaties. There was even a treaty, the so-called International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, which is supposed to counteract that. It hasn't been very effective the way that I can see it, actually. So I see a fairly negative situation in terms of biological materials.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that too, because the material transfer agreements are something my office handles. And you're right. From my observation, some things have gotten a lot easier to do, and a lot of them have gotten a lot more complicated, just for the reasons you were saying. And it's really unfortunate, because the original material transfer agreements some years ago were very, very simple, two-page documents. And now sometimes they might be 40, 50, 60 pages long, when our professors are trying to get the material that they need in order to do their research, and we can't get it in a timely fashion. That's very harmful to research progress. And that's right, the international treaties have not been helpful. Sometimes it gets to be extraordinarily complicated to get anything out, and it's not getting better. It is getting harder. There is, within the U.S. and among academic institutions, sharing data and material can be a lot easier than, as long as those institutions are willing to agree to use this uniform biological material transfer agreement. Even those institutions sometimes get hung up on protection of intellectual property rights, and that even though they may have signed on to use those agreements, they won't, and they'll want to have a more complex material transfer agreement. So it's been our observation that it is getting harder, and it does sometimes take an inordinate amount of time, or never, to get the material.
The practical thing that you have to think of, if you are thinking of putting in a proposal that involves biological material, make sure you have the agreements before submitting it, or at least a reasonable chance of getting it,
yeah.
Because the reviewers may get hung up on the authorizations.
I'm curious about the analogy of the material stuff to digital data. It's certainly we know it's very easy to pass digital data between people, and the you see that with music, and we have all these copyright. Should we be thinking about digital data as material, or is there an alternative way to think about it in terms of software and digital things, and how to transfer that, and should it fall under the same rules as the materials?
Would they bring everything to a screeching halt?
Well, if you look at the, I was struck by the taxonomy. Again, I'm looking at the NSF document here, and basically they talk about IP, data, and then tangible property. So they have these three categories, right? So, and the IP data distinction is pretty clear. You know, it's like, you know, content, content form and copyright, or the fact that you can't patent products of nature. So, that's a pretty clear divide, right? But then they don't put data into tangible property. They don't fold it into tangible property, because they say that people have, that the NSF recognizes the tangible property produced by the scientist through their grant. So in a sense, so data is this thing in between. It's neither tangible property nor intellectual property, and they mark it as separate. It's a third animal.
One question, could you comment on what you think the driving forces for why it's become harder for these material transfers to happen? What has changed and who's pushing that?
It gets down to the point of people wanting to protect intellectual property, and I think a misuse of when you need to protect intellectual property and when you don't. One of my functions is to look at discoveries and see whether or not it should be protected, but you always have to take, I think, a perspective of what is it that we're really trying to do. At a university, it's not about patenting. I mean, patents are not our product. Publications are research. So sometimes the only way to get discoveries out for public benefit is if somebody else can take it the final step, because what we do here is academic research, not commercial research. So to that extent, filing a patent so that someone will want to spend the time and money to develop it is in our direct mission. But many times, the concept of transferring materials, people tend to view it as a loss of intellectual property to the extent that they don't want to have anything go out of their hands, that they're not going to get the other person's intellectual property that comes from that for themselves. This makes it very, very complicated and a fairness issue, but the result is that it slows everything down. And so I think it's a function of people misunderstanding what their missions are and how intellectual property should be protected and sometimes should not be.
I think that it's, there is an issue of confusion, I think, because if I go to Mexico, for example, and there's some biodiversity that might be of interest, Mexico now says, well, we will not release those materials if they're going to be genetically engineered and patented, for example. And they view institutions in the U.S., like the USDA, like universities, as being a direct instrument for patenting, because the same institution does patenting or does not. They say, well, as long as there is a possibility for patenting, and that kind of stops that transfer of materials right there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really, that's what stops it. Like you said, it's the possibility of intellectual property.
Right.
Really interferes with the exchange.
Just a few weeks ago, we had an example where we were trying to get material from Mexico. It was a special type of plant seed. And they had very specific restricted conditions on what our professor could use that material for. And in order for him to get his research done, we had to agree that it would be very restrictive. And that was, of course, with the professor's, you know, clear buy-in on that. But it does make our ability to do research sometimes quite restricted. It's a good example.
Wasn't there a lot of commercial exploitation by pharmaceutical companies of rainforest products and traditional medicines, and that there are some rather poor countries that lost revenue that was basically based on their own sort of native traditional cultural stuff and their products. So I think there's some sensitivity at the national level that died.
Material difference, in the impact of, between withholding a license to intellectual property or withholding the transfer of the material thing, is that if you withhold the transfer of the material thing, you really block the person. I mean, if you deny a license to IP, the person can still either try to patent around or simply infringe and then say, okay, look, take me to court. But if which I'm not suggesting in any way that you guys should do. But if you withhold the material thing that you need, you need a block. So it has a much stronger impact.
I have a question. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I was going to take one from our sheet that's more from the graduate student perspective, since we're at the graduate student symposium. As a graduate student, if I was expected to share my data, I might be not very inclined to, because in a way it's a unit of power to get the next job, right? I have data that I can publish on and things like that, and if I share it with everybody, maybe I have less advantage to make it forward in my career. In contrast, that with a tenured professor, they may not have to advance anymore, so maybe it's a lot easier just to open up everything they do and share it. How do the career implications of sharing and not sharing matter? What do you all think about it, maybe from the professor's perspectives?
First off, we've dichotomized sharing. It's either fully open or it's not. And I think that there's, we need to talk about degrees of sharing. And it's important, whether it's in this context or any other. And so that I could see, problems with just posting your data and say anybody has access to it as a graduate student. But certainly I come back to the benefits that I've had of sharing is that you engage with, you broaden your network. They, in turn, the people you're working with, sharing your data with, have other people they know and so forth. so that you can build on that. And then furthermore, these papers that come out of it, just really new perspectives on the data and so forth. So, you know, I mean, you have to go into all these things, eyes wide open and so forth. But on the other hand, I would see a lot of benefits to at least considering different degrees of sharing as a graduate student.
Does anyone else have a comment?
I can't answer that question for you, but when I was doing research for this panel, I did come across something from the American Psychological Association and a blog post, actually, that from a graduate student who said, this is great. If the professors have to share their data, we can use it, right? Like, we have access to all this data that no way would I ever have the money, the time, the resources to go and collect myself, right, to do these big longitudinal population studies or whatever. So there is that side of it for the graduate student community, I think. You have gained access to more things if data is opened up and if publications are opened up. It's like the benefits of open access. You know, you gain access to more research.
Follow-up question maybe on the misuse of data. I finished my master's degree in environmental engineering, and I'm thinking of, you know, in an engineering study, and maybe this is applicable in statistics or not applicable in other fields, but there's a lot of assumptions behind certain data collection, and I'm wondering if any of the panelists would have any concern with the misuse of data because somebody that is using that data doesn't understand all of the assumptions behind the data collected, or especially outside of the realm of academia where there's not peer review. I'm looking at moving into the consulting world where a consultant, if they see a chance to get ahead and the data is supporting a project or review they have, they will grab that and run with it, and there's no review process whatsoever.
Well, it's a complicated question. I think we only have a couple of remedies include peer review of data itself. So we, for example, working with our publications program at the California Digital Library, they have 40 online journals and peer review established for some of them. We hope to, our pilot with this data paper idea is to try to gradually establish some sort of peer review, whatever that means, we're not sure, for data. So at least you get a sense of the quality of the data and the provenance. You still can't obviously control the misuse of it any more than you can control the misuse of a publication. But it's a start.
I'll just comment on that. There's all these hypotheticals and horror stories, and they make it into science, and then, you know, you can't necessarily generalize that. And my view is that one thing about making at least public, when I present data that's preliminary or early on, I just feel like I've protected myself with that, because now it's public, and anybody that would run with it, they have to account to the larger community that I just presented to as well. I mean, it's a small world out there, and you can't be, you run with the data like that, somebody else's data, at your peril. So I don't see a lot of abuse like that, and so that would be my take on it.
Thank you. I guess I'll ask the next question. It was touched on in the previous comments in regards to open access publishing in this plan. What are your thoughts on the choice of where you publish your paper? We're taking all this effort to make our data accessible to, in theory, public at large. Should we do the same thing with the paper? Or not? What decisions do you have to make when you decide where to publish and whether or not to publish open access?
Let me piggyback on that. Also, now there are a number of repositories cropping up. Some journals allow you to upload the data. University repositories, some repository like Brian that are specific to field of studies. How do we navigate that?
Bottom
just a practical mention, I think that University of California has a contract with Springer, and any Springer journal would publish a paper in open access if there was an author belonging to it. Is that too right?
Not anymore, unfortunately. I'm very sorry. It was a trial. It was a trial, and the trial is over. They wouldn't give us to us again. So you can pay them more money now. We had a cut rate for UC. It was free for UCPIs. So I think that was a great move on our part. I would love to see it again. Our journal negotiations with publishers like Springer and Elsevier, the big publishers, are incredibly complex and involve millions of dollars. And open access got lost in this latest round. But if that's something that the research community would like to see, they should let the libraries know. That, broadly speaking.
See what?
Open access contracts, like the Springer deal, which said that you can publish open access in a Springer journal for free. We do, I'll just add on to that and say the libraries do support many open access initiatives. We fund some repositories. We're trying to be very supportive of open access, and there are many options out there in the field, commercial or not. So.
Can you just say, Leo, how do we lobby the library?
With signs and pickets, maybe not. Maybe the better way would just actually to write your... Every department on campus has a librarian associated with it, assigned to it. That's relatively easy to find if you look in the library directories, or maybe you already know that person. Talk to us, and we can get it higher up the chain. So that's the easiest
because
way.
Because they also compare page charges, is that right?
That's separate page charges. I'm not sure. That wasn't part of it.
Here's a side note. Did you know that PLOS One does not provide galleys? Did you know this?
They don't provide what?
Galleys. What is a galley? A galley has in proofs of your paper.
But PLOS does. That's just PLOS One.
I don't know, but I mean, we have just, I mean, I know this isn't relevant.
Sure.
I just corrected because we had all kinds of mistakes in our time. My goodness. I guess the galleys are post-publication, and you can go back in. Anyways, bizarre.
PLOS is the Public Library of Science. They were one of the first big open access publishers and have published some very prestigious journals in the life sciences. So,
I'd like to mention that, this publishing is, we all kind of wonder what are we getting for our money with some of the big publishers, and open access is coming along. While online publishing is certainly big, and all the publishers, open and not so open, are putting more and more supplementary material online. And supplementary material includes, everything that could be essential but wasn't published because it wouldn't fit in the paper page limit, the page limits, and can include data as well. I think that back to the original question, that the relationship between open access publishing and data sharing is probably a positive one because. Certainly, there are lots of plenty of journals which claim to have policies that require the archiving of these data sets, but in fact, compliance is about 10% or less, and even after they've been informed, there's no policing of this. So, but the fact is that they're set up to hold these supplementary material, including data. So I think that generally that's a positive correlation.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't answer your question either, but the impetus behind both is very similar. So we're at a public university, right? Here's the impetus for open access. You get a grant from the NSF, the NIH, another federal agency that's, large, is funded with taxpayer dollars. You, in turn, come to a public university, which is funded with taxpayer dollars, and do your work. And then you publish, you write an article, and you publish in a journal, and you publish in Springer, or you publish in Elsevier, or Wiley. And they say, great, we're going to publish. Here's your Nature article. And then the libraries, which are funded with taxpayer money, buy those journal packages for millions and millions of dollars of your tuition money. and give you access back to them, which is restricted only to people on the public campus, right? This seems problematic. And it's similarly problematic for this data, which is produced in exactly the same manner, right? So that's the impetus. I think they're related. The questions of where to publish are tricky, right? Tricky and individual and dependent on many, many things like your career. So those questions have not been answered satisfactorily and definitively, as far as certainly as far as I know.
Well, you know, yeah. Open access. This is relevant to the data sharing and so forth. But well, around open access, I think NSF now has a policy. There's some outreach component, isn't that right? I thought there was, but anyway, we developed, if people are interested in you writing grants, but we developed a major section along with our data sharing, but also for program outreach. And we really, you know, thought deeply about this. And so if you're interested, I mean, we have public outreach, you have what we call pedagogical outreach, that is some of this, you know, research is actually teach to and bringing this into the classroom, and then professional outreach. And so that maps in a little bit to this. Open access. So
it's sort of in the broader impacts section.
It is. That's right.
Yeah.
I'm curious if people actually use the data that we share. If we put it all out there, we think that certainly somebody may grab it and do something with it, but are there examples of people really using the data? And that seems like that would certainly be an incentive to do it, but if not, maybe I don't really to bother with it because it is a lot of work. So do people use the data that we share?
There's a whole set, you know, NIH, they have secondary data analysis, I mean, whole grants that you can go after to, use these data. And so that, you know, typically we gather data and you just cream off the main, whatever the purpose, you know, whatever your design the experiment for. But in fact, the data are what they are. There's many other questions that can be addressed there. So there's grants to go after, secondary data analysis there. So clearly, there's a lot of data out there that's being shared, that's being used again.
I think this gets to that question of incentives, right? So this is a sort of complicated question, but you have to be able to measure its use, for example, and you also, you may have published in a paper that doesn't get used also, but you would get credit if it was a prestigious journal, for example, so you wouldn't mind as much. If we were able to change the culture to create sort of data publication as a kind of a first-class data academic output, that would be one thing. And then if you had good citations and persistent, unique identifiers, then you could actually do track its usage. How often is it cited? So those are things which would help you get to the point of, was that worth it? Will it be worth it next time?
We have a question.
I still have another kind of concern. I think it's nice to format the data and share and make it accessible to everybody. But sometimes it still is unavoidable. The data may be redundant or maybe unreliable. That I may need some additional information to maybe evaluate the data, and do you have any efficient way to do that on some kind of server?
So the question is, how do we kind of verify that we're not putting redundant data? And
how much metadata do we need to
understand? This came up with, we had a population biology workshop here a month or two ago, but I asked John that about how do you review a paper. How do you review a data set? What would be the criteria and so forth? So maybe you can speak to that.
Nobody really knows how to peer review data, there are some interesting examples. There's certain data sets that nobody knows the value of until they're used and until they're annotated, but that's very community specific. So I have a feeling that early exposure, early sharing of your data is going to be very important for making decisions and quality assessments of, is this good? Through usage, errors will get corrected. Through usage, it'll be determined that it, in fact, is redundant.
people may not know that for 5 years or even 20 years after it's made available somewhere. So it may look a bit, or quite a bit different from normal paper peer review, but that's something we don't quite know how to do it yet, but some methods will be arising, I think.
So basically we should do it and figure out as we do it what makes sense and sort of evolve the process. Another question. So if you're from a discipline that doesn't have a lot of data, or the people in your discipline don't have any sort of standards on how to share the data, can any of you give advice on how to go about designing a data plan, how to decide what formats to store your data in, and these types of things, and exactly how to kind of format everything so that it will be usable? If there's no one else, if there's no example to kind of follow in your field, what approach would you advise?
Yeah, this was a little ad hoc. I mean, I guess I said this up front too. I mean, firstly, lay out your game. Why are you collecting the data, and why do you want to archive and manage and so forth? And then, but even that, in all, this is just personally, whenever I create a new Excel sheet, for example, one of the sheets is devoted to key. So all the coding is just on that sheet. I can always go back to that and say, FX means what, and and for that column and whatnot. And a little bit about the method, so I always put that in. And then for the coding, you come up with, so that each file, you have some different field within that file for coding the, the file. So that there's a system there that everyone follows that same sequence, and each field within that has it, I mean, it was a little bit ad hoc, but at least we tried to make it more systematic than you just end up with a hodgepodge of whatever files, not the file name, rather.
Here is the answer from the NSF. Here's the question, a frequently asked question. There is no public database of my type of data. What can I do to provide data access? Answer: contact the Cognizant NSF program officer for assistance in this situation.
Yes, I think the fact provides a lot of answers. If you want to have a good laugh.
You're right here in the back. I did want to mention, and I'm talking an awful lot for someone who knows nothing really about data. But I work for a library, so we do have some general guidelines for sort of safe generic practices, which may not get you very far in the community, but it's better than nothing. I wanted to mention, we also have this data management plan tool, which is going to be an online tool, which will be sensitive to your institution and to the funding agency you're applying to. Run you through a couple of questions, and help will pop something that looks like a data management plan that you can then finish editing and submit with your grant proposal. Also, in consistent with what Jim was saying, we just got funding from Microsoft Research to work on this Excel spreadsheet add-in. It's going to be a source add-in which will make Excel data more shareable and archivable by, we're not quite sure what the requirements will be, but things like documenting the column headings, standardizing the date formats, removing macros, which make it really hard to share the stuff, that sort of thing. So recognize that Excel is not the best, the coolest database program, but it's just so ubiquitous and familiar, and so many people use it, but get some good leverage this way.
Can you tell us where to find the online tool?
I'm not sure the exact. If you go to the CDL website, cdl.org, under query data management plan, there's a tool being developed with the Smithsonian, University of Virginia, University of California libraries, and a couple other partners, and that's going to be. We expect to have
that done in a couple of months.
Yeah, the tool's not up, but you can find the CDL also through the library, our library webpage, if you look for data management.
So, we'll take this one more question, and then I got one sort of final wrap-up question, and we'll close it off with a few audience.
I had a question. A lot of the conversation really has revolved more around communication within the scientific community with data sharing, but I wonder about this. We are seeing a more of an increasing sort of porousness, I think, sometimes between a sort of academic and lay community, and where and how and who sort of comes to be an expertise, is seen as an expert, and within what community they're seen as an expert. And I think that and with sort of more data becoming available to a larger public, I guess I wonder if anyone would want to speculate as to, is this part of the conversation? Is this something we need to think about? Because some of the, there are great benefits to this, as we can see, for example, in the environmental justice movement, but there are also great travails to this, as we can see of the sort of like debates in this country around climate change. And so I guess how would you comment on that?
Taxpayers, that way.
I mean, I don't know about data sharing, but I mean, there's a few, Elizabeth knows this, I mean, I guess I touched on this a bit with the outreach, but there's, you know, I've been involved with developed this UCTV seminar network concept that I chaired the University Committee on Research Policy here a couple years ago, and one thing our committee did was publish this paper in PLOS Biology on developing UC seminar network where anywhere in the UC system could be accessed to the computer. But that's for synergy within the research community, but then again, the public can also access that as well. And so just for this is sort of an FYI, but I mean, in about 3 weeks or a month, UCTV is launching this new platform based on what our committee developed called UCTV Seminars. And so that all the weekly seminars that are captured, just like we're doing right here for this panel, in fact, this could be uploaded there too, you know, will be accessible to anybody in the system, but also anybody in the world. And so I see this is where, and again, getting back to our development of this outreach, that sort of maps into that as well. And I see the NSF, the NIH, all these grants, we are accountable to the public, it is public money. And so that to be able to integrate these concepts into our grants, I think is a trend here and something that everybody may be thinking about. So anyway, probably didn't quite answer your question, but anyway, it's this public engagement, I think, is an important part of what we do.
I was gonna say, just to put it a little more concisely, the way I'm thinking about it is, do we allow the public at large to participate in our science? And is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's definitely one aspect of it.
I mean, I think thinking of it as a bright line between the research community and the public is not always helpful. I have more experience thinking about this in terms of open access advocacy than I do in terms of data sharing, so it's not quite the same. But your publics include people at small colleges that cannot afford a subscription to Springer Journals and therefore will not read your article. Like, your publics include researchers at universities around the world, researchers in universities in Africa, in Europe, in Asia. Your publics include lay scientists who might be curious. Your publics also include people at companies who are trying to develop things, and they also don't have access to your articles that are published in the big journals. Your publics include the people who write Wikipedia and want to cite something authoritative, right? Your publics include all sorts of people. And yes, the vast majority of people won't understand your data or your work or your research or whatever. But I think it helps to make it possible to make it open. You know, if you have a choice between reading the definitive Nature article on climate change or not reading it and relying on Fox News, I want them to at least have the option to try, you know? So that's, I mean, as I said, the issues in data sharing are different and complicated, but in open access, those are some of the reasons to make things open.
Question.
A really quick follow-up as librarians, what are some of the options of those publics? I really liked how you put that, the many publics, including people that may be experts or considered experts in their field but don't have access to academia. How can they, is it affordable for an individual to gain access to all of this?
So before we go too long, we've got about 7 more minutes. Yeah, so let's make this real quick.
I think I can address a little bit of both. Any person can walk into a library and get access to the journal. So it's always a background if you walk in. But I was going to mention the NSF, not in the data management plan, but like the Data One project, is doing a lot of outreach to sort of the citizen science, which includes high school bird watching groups, et cetera, who and looking to archive their data. So this is in absence of a requirement to do so because they're not, quote unquote, scientists. But that data is considered a very valuable part of the whole patchwork, especially in Earth observation. So there is some attention going to that.
Right. Last question.
So maybe we can have everybody speak in the last question. I was just going to say, where can we learn more about this topic? So if everybody could lead us all into a next, spot, whether it's an internet site or a book or other people, how can we learn more if we leave today?
I have a quick comment. The Office of Research here at UC Davis did produce a sample data management plan that you can get access to. It's not intended to be a template, you just fill in the blanks, but it's one to show you. It's a two-page one that conforms to what NSF is asking for, so all you got to do is get on the website and contact Office of Research. Sponsored programs, which handles contracts and grants, can provide you with that sample data management plan.
Fantastic. Maybe everybody else can go down the line and
I think that we all look for models, and I think this would be a great model. I have one, too, if anybody wanted to email me. But let me just say this, UC Curation Center, I'll just put a plug in for this as a researcher. This is a fantastic resource, and everybody should go to that website, and you can kind of walk through there's concepts there of curation and so on, retrieval, and you always think of sort of library books this way, but now you think about data, so it's a really useful resource. I really recommend that they do that.
If you go to the library website, which is lib.ucdavis.edu, and search for data management, I think that's the easiest way to find it. We just put up a page that links to CDL, the UC Curation Center, and so you can get a link to their sample data management plan. There's also a couple other examples from other universities there, from University of Virginia, particularly from MIT, of sample data management plans and ideas for how to approach this. I'll say every university and every library system, this is a hot topic and everyone's sort of scrambling to catch up with the NSF requirements, and there's sort of no cut and dried way to do it yet. So we've got examples there on the website. You can contact within the libraries for help with the mechanics of it. You can contact me, and there's also a few other people listed on that page, depending on whether you're in the health sciences or biology. But the Office of Research and the libraries are, we're the two main points on campus for these issues. So
I'll just reiterate that the campus library should be your starting point, I think, and for all information. We'll have all the best local institutional resources available. If you're going wider, it's also, you could consider, is a digital curation center in the UK has done a lot of work and conducts a lot of training and education, has lots of reports out on this topic.
I think that, of course, if you are planning to, put in some NSF or NIH application, obviously you need to look at the kind of templates that that David's office is providing. My gut feeling is that probably you should revisit the issue regularly, because based on the discussions that I've read last night to prep for this panel, It's really quite remarkable that, you know, at least the NSF is explicit about basically using the next rounds of grant application and the feedback from the peer reviewers to come up with the best practices about, you know, field-specific best practices about definition of data and protocols of sharing and so on. So it looks like the field, the discussion is going to change quite quickly in the near future. That would be my guess.
So the type of data I'm working with is mostly DNA at this stage, and so there is already a long-standing example of a database, GenBank, and the journals actually require you to deposit the sequences in GenBank. They want to see the codes in the manuscript. So I think that GenBank in general would be a source of information. It's fairly bureaucratic, but it's on there. The other aspect is biodiversity. I'm mostly working with crops, and so there are like the Global Crop Biodiversity Trust, which operates, you may know, that gene bank in the above the Arctic Circle in Norway, but they have information also on the web. Also, the USDA has the, what we call GRIN, the Genetic Resources Information Network. There's also information online there. So.
Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause to our panel.